Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. If you'd like to watch today's program, you can go to Ustream and then go to Gary Null, and you can watch. We're going to talk about blood pressure medications given right after a stroke don't benefit you. Study shows why breastfed babies are so smart, why dark chocolate is so good for your heart, and it doesn't take much sugar to wreak havoc in your body, and more. Then we're going to give you from our public health segment, studies now prove that without a doubt that unvaccinated children are far healthier than vaccinated children. And this is from a major study in Immunization Awareness Society. And why haven't we been told about this? Well, we've unearthed it, so we will. Also from our public health segment today, drug companies killing kids for profit by Dr. Stuart Bramhill, and the myth of childhood bipolar disorders, and drug companies are deliberately breaking the law. I'll give you that insight. Then, from our social issues segment, that a lot of you say that you enjoy, because we don't do what you find on the other blogs and Huffington Post, we look for things that inspire a deeper understanding from a progressive, meaning truth. That's all progressive really is, seeking the truth and positive solutions. 6 reasons to stop fighting wars from David Swanson. Commentary today on how we become such a totalitarian and fascistic state. This falls in alignment with the series I've been doing every week for the past 2 years on fascism in America and how we are indeed a police state. This is going to be from Professor Henry Giroux, Truth Out. My guest in the second part of our program will be revealing things that no American media has touched. Documentation, for the first time, looking deep into the state behind the protests and violence in Venezuela with Ava Golinger. She's a Venezuelan-American attorney and editor of the Venezuelan government-supported newspaper, and she served briefly as a foreign policy advisor to the late Hugo Chavez. Now, the information she's going to share, because we always ask to verify all the facts of our guests, and we have scholars in residence here at our office at 83rd and Broadway, that, by the way, if you've never visited, you should. It's a unique building, and tens of thousands of people have visited. It was a theater in 1900, so it has this huge 25-foot-high ceiling, a big room where the theater was, and these old Art Deco rooms throughout. Anyhow, we have people that all they do is verify facts, and they have no political allegiance, just the truth, and that's why I hire them, and because I want to make sure that what we send out is accurate, because a lot of people rely upon it. A lot of people use the information to support movements, to form lawsuits, to defluoridate water supplies, for example, to challenge immunization policies, to challenge the legitimacy of genetic engineering or gas hydrofracking or other challenges to the environment. All of the information comes from the Freedom of Information Act. So we'll show you what role the United States government played. You will not believe what you're going to hear, even if you're one of the hardened people who've seen the truth. This will surprise you. Let's begin. There's this myth that if you start taking your blood pressure meds right after having a stroke, that'll prevent another stroke. This is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is a major study that found that giving stroke patients medications to lower their blood pressure during the first 48 hours after a stroke does not reduce the likelihood of death or major disability. Now, my thoughts on this. I would suggest that the very first thing you do once you've stabilized the person, and generally they'll give them magnesium sulfate, that's almost in every emergency room, get them into a hyperbaric oxygen chamber. The quicker someone is put into a hyperbaric oxygen chamber, the more likely they are to survive. Even if it's weeks, months, even years after a stroke, it can still protect parts of the brain. And then look at something different. Look at what will naturally thin the blood and keep it from coagulating or aggregating and creating the clumps that end up blocking the artery. Vitamin E, tocotrienols, vitamin C, quercetin, onions and garlic, and also easily to use would be juices, especially your dark green juices, celery, cucumber, green apple, great for thinning the blood. That would make a difference. Sprouting garlic, and I've never heard anyone sprouting garlic, packed with heart-healthy antioxidants. So this new research, and this is from the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. The research was done in South Korea. And what they found is old garlic bulbs that have grown sprouts are often considered past their prime. However, new research suggests that aging bulbs of garlic have higher levels of heart-healthy antioxidants than their fresh counterparts. And the team of researchers behind this study investigated whether sprouting enhanced the antioxidant activity of garlic after noting that the sprouting of plant seeds generally promotes the new synthesis of bioactive compounds which protect the plant from external stressors. Quote, although garlic has been extensively studied for its health benefits, sprouted garlic has received little attention. And then they went in to find out what happened. And they found out, quote, therefore, sprouting may be a useful way to improve the antioxidant potential of garlic. So for all your farmers out there, that's good information, something we wouldn't have known. Vitamin D has a direct effect on brain development, social behavior, and autism. This is from the FASEB Journal, a major scientific study. So what this says is that vitamin D could have a critical influence on serotonin in the brain, and that directly affects social behaviors associated with autism spectrum disorder. This was led by Professor Bruce Ames, Children's Hospital, Oakland Research Institute, and the study demonstrated that serotonin and oxytocin and vasopressin, three brain hormones that affect social behavior, are all activated by vitamin D. Quote, we present evidence that vitamin D activates the transcription of the serotonin-synthesizing gene tryptophan hydroxylase 2 in the brain at a vitamin D response element and represses the transcription of TPH1 in tissues outside the brain-blood barrier. So, in lay language, take vitamin D, helps your mood, allows you to feel less anxious, and have less social anxiety. I'm pretty sure that most of you, if you're over the age of 40, were more likely than not to have been breastfed. The older you are, the more likely you are to have been breastfed for a longer period of time. There was a time when mothers breastfed up to 2 years, a year to 2 years, was not uncommon. In some societies in the world, especially the Bushmen of the Kalahari, they'll breastfeed for about 3 years. The longer you breastfeed, the healthier the child. Here's the latest on breastfeeding from Brigham Young University. Quote, loads of studies over the years have shown that children who are breastfed score higher on IQ tests and perform better in school. But the reason why remained unclear. It is the mother-baby bonding time, something in the milk itself, or something unseen attributable to this process. Now, a new study by sociologists at Brigham Young University pinpoints two parenting skills as the real source of this cognitive boost. Responding to children's emotional cues and reading to children starting at 9 months of age. Breastfeeding mothers tend to do both of those things. Quote, it's really the parenting that makes the difference. Breastfeeding matters in other ways, but this actually gives a better mechanism and can shape our confidence about interventions that promote school readiness, end quote. So, this was published in the peer-reviewed journal of Pediatrics. So, when you're breastfeeding, you're also talking to and singing and bonding on that emotional level. But then reading to your child, also, you're more likely to. But it's also, if you're doing yoga, you're doing meditation, you're taking vitamins each day, you're more likely not to be smoking, not to be drinking. You're more likely to do other things that are healthy. So it just goes to reason that if a person is really wanting the best for their child, they're going to read to them also and play music for them. Why dark chocolate is good for your heart. This again is from a major scientific journal, FASEB Journal. It shows that consuming dark chocolate lowers the augmentation index. That means that's a key vascular health predictor that reduces the adhesion of white blood cells to the blood vessel wall. So when you're having the dark chocolate, the chemicals in the dark chocolate, the natural phytochemicals, help prevent this arterial stiffness and the white blood cell adhesion. So that's great. Quote, we provide a more complete picture of the impact of chocolate consumption in vascular health and show that increasing flavanol content has known added benefit on the vascular health. However, the increased flavanol content clearly affected taste and therefore the motivation to eat these chocolates. So the dark chocolate is a healthy one. And then they went on to talk about other aspects. Recently, we published a major article, Killing Us Sweetly. It is the most definitive scientific-based article ever written on the subject of sugar. It is everything current of what's wrong with sugar from the peer-reviewed scientific literature. Now, against that truth is a multi-billion-dollar sugar industry. Think of all the soft drinks. Think of the high-fructose corn syrup industry. So, they had the media. We had the truth. We have to get our message out. So my suggestion is read the article and share it with everyone you know who's concerned about their health and doesn't think a little bit of sugar is a problem. Even a little bit of sugar is a problem. And we show that. The article is entitled Killing Us Sweetly. And you can go to GaryAndAll.com or ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com and download it. And we try to post 40 to 60 new articles per day. And I'm writing one new article per week. Tomorrow, I will be presenting a unique article. You won't want to miss this on the air. It'll take about the first half hour. I'm calling out virtually all the power brokers on Wall Street as psychopaths, not sociopaths, psychopaths. And I document how I can prove that the heads of these banks and financial institutions and the hedge funds and equity partnerships, they're psychopaths. So this is a new essay that'll be posted tomorrow. It's actually up today and on the website. But I'll be presenting to the larger audience because not everyone has access to the internet. To give you an idea that we are able, working together, creating and sharing information that's essential to our well-being or the planet or animals, or cultures or genders, protecting one another's from the common exploitation that's occurring now. Google, seeds of death. Look at how many people are looking in their search engines for that title. And you'll see that the first 5.5 pages on Google, it's Seeds of Death, the documentary. 95 million search results. That's a bunch. War on Health is even more. It's 1,400,000,000 as of this morning. Now, that doesn't mean everyone's watched that film. That's not what it means. It means that in that title, people are finding that we're the first, I think, 7 pages. That means that people are seeking out information, finding it. What they do with it's their business. Then there's all these sites where hundreds of thousands of people are then watching the films, then sharing it with other people. And hence, we, the people, are sharing information we can use to stop genetic engineering, to protect organic and local farming, to challenge the medical industrial complex, to challenge unnecessary procedures. So don't be negative in thinking that somehow we're just people. We don't have billion-dollar bank accounts and lobbying firms, but we have the internet. At least at this moment we do, and we have each other to share. Please keep sharing and spreading the information. This is from Joanne Richardson from Alternet. It doesn't take much sugar for it to wreak havoc on your body. Here's what it says. Nicolette Nyman, author of Righteous Pork Chop, just coined a new catchphrase that ought to go viral. Sugar is not just an empty calorie. Her statement contradicts the notion we've had for years that the worst thing about sugar is its lack of nutrients. Either you're eating sugar in addition to all the other calories you need to stay healthy, or you're eating it instead of them. In the former case, you're getting too many calories. In the latter case, you're getting too few nutrients. This idea is so dominant, it was recently cited in an anti-sugar op-ed in The Guardian. Even if that was the case, we're eating too much sugar, or more specifically, too much added sugar. Sugars that are naturally present in whole foods, like fruits, are okay. It's the sugar added to whole foods that we must worry about. Previously, the World Health Organization said we should limit consumption of added sugars to 10% of calories. Even then, more than 7 in 10 Americans ate too much sugar. On average, 15% of our calories come from added sugars. But now the World Health Organization is considering cutting its recommendation in half. That means limiting sugar consumption to 5 teaspoons, the amount found in half a can of soda. The American Heart Association has long recommended that women limit added sugars to 6 teaspoons and men stick to 9 or less. Nyman was examining the health impacts of sugar at the same time as the World Health Organization. In researching and writing her latest book, she dug into studies that found evidence sugar does more than just lack nutrients. Quote, the sugar is going to actually damage your body. It's not just that you're not getting the nutrients. Now, the link between sugar and disease is not new. Decades ago, nutrition professor John Yutkin wrote a book called Pure White and Deadly, in which he posited that sugar was the culprit behind heart disease and type 2 diabetes. The food industry fought back. This was the era of low fat or low sugar. The general term sugar can mean any number of things. Table sugar or sucrose is composed of glucose molecule bonded to fructose. Glucose is what plants make during photosynthesis. It's about half as sweet as table sugar. Fructose, naturally found in honey and many fruits, is 70% sweeter than table sugar. On your tongue, you'll taste a difference in sweetness between glucose and fructose. And once in your body, the difference continues. Glucose is metabolized by every cell of your body. After you eat, your blood glucose level rises and your body releases insulin. The insulin helps your muscles, fat, and liver absorb the glucose and decreases your blood sugar. Levels of another hormone, leptin, L-E-P-T-I-N, also rise. Leptin regulates your appetite. once you've eaten and your body has plenty of fuel to keep going. Leptin tells you to stop. Another hormone, ghrelin, decreases. Now, fructose, on the other hand, is only metabolized by your liver. And so that's not cool. So it goes on to talk about how bad a little bit of sugar is. I knew John Yutkin. I went to England to interview him. And he said that his word would not be taken seriously, even though he was the first chair of a nutrition department in Europe. He published many papers. He was an MD, PhD, because he said there's an enormous industry that's up against him, and they control advertising, and they'll win the day. He was right. But the truth is still there. Eat sugar, but only eat it when it's in the form of natural. For example, if I have some fresh pineapple and cherries, I'm going to get about 10 grams of sugar, and that's fine, because that's only going to be good. Why? Because I'm going to get the phytonutrients from the cherries. I'm going to get the anti-inflammatory nutrients, especially good for your joints and your muscles. From the pineapple, I'm getting bromelain, which is so important for digestion and turning off inflammation everywhere in the body, plus the key antioxidants. So cherries and pineapple are phenomenally healing and healthy. But they are sweet, but it's a natural sugar, and it's a tiny amount. It is 1/4 teaspoon. That's how many 10 grams are. So it's a small amount. So people freak when they see any form of sugar. Make sure you know the source of your sugar. Once you do, then you'll know whether it's from fructose or glucose or naturally occurring. Otherwise, you would never have any Manuka honey. Oh, by the way, I have put up on my website a photograph of some of my bees. A lot of people, a lot of even new people getting into beekeeping in the city or in the country, find that in the wintertime, especially if it's a bad winter, their bees disappear. Well, either one of two things are happening. A, you're not feeding them. What do you mean? You're supposed to feed a bee? Yes, every day. Or B, they go to where they can find food or die. So even in Florida, even when you have wonderful 70 and 80 degree days, you don't get your blooms until March and April. And that's when the flowers start to come, the wildflowers and the palms start to become fertile. And then the bee has something to eat. It's able to get nectar. Well, what do you think they're going to eat during December, January, and February? And that's where we see the colony disappearing or thinning out. So here's what you do. You get a thin pole, and you put some form of a stickiness on it, like a grease. And on top of that pole, you put a plate. And in the plate, each day you put a cup of honey, raw organic honey. The bees will find it, the bees will eat it, then the bees won't starve to death, and they won't fly away. And then, as the new larva hatches, they will be nourished. And within about a month, you'll go from hundreds or dozens to thousands. And within 2 months, tens of thousands of bees. And that's how you keep your bees healthy and strong. And I took a photograph, or I didn't take it. One of the people took a photograph and posted it, because someone says, when I was saying you got to feed your bees, and I feed my bees, show us what it is. So now you see it. You go up there. Also, I mentioned the other day, I was watching about 20 minutes in an airport of all the different dance parties. If any of you have any films that you took over the years over dance parties, please send them to me. I'm back in New York now. And if they're good enough to go up, meaning if we can actually see people, because most of them are too dark, we'll put them up. But there were so many wonderful energies. Oh, people were having a ball. Everyone was smiling. And imagine having as many as 5,000 or 6,000 people at a single party. No alcohol, no drugs, no smoking. Just people enjoying each other. And I recognized so many people. I must have recognized, right there was, in one shop, was Roberta Addy. Most people don't realize Roberta Addy, when she was in her late teens, was considered Italy's top model. She was a fashion model. She was just drop-dead gorgeous. And she hadn't lost that. You see it in the video. And Marie Eder and Kathy Davis and Alex Steinberg and Steve Brown and all these people, I was looking at them at the different dance parties. Thousands. You ought to take a look to see if you can find yourself. And I will be lining up another dance party, which I haven't done in years, in the next month. And of course, it'll be free. It'll be a celebration of that point in the year. And we'll see how many people come back, even if it's 30 years later, and enjoy an evening of great fun and dancing. So go up and look at them. Those are the nice things. Also, once a year, I share my wardrobe with people here at our office at 83rd and Broadway. I just brought it in today because of all the television appearances I do on PBS stations and lectures. I take those items and I give them as gifts. One to a person, and there's a lot. Suits, shoes, clothes, all nice stuff. And so if you want, you can come by and pick one out for yourself or give something to a friend. If you want it, need it, it's there. There's probably 100 items. And before we go to our guest in a moment, I'm very concerned that we as a society are losing our rights and we're not paying attention to how much control others are having over our actions. I would think we would look at things differently if every time you picked up a phone, suddenly a curtain parted and you had 3,000 or 4,000 people watching you, listening to your conversation. Or if you went to write a love letter to a friend over the internet and everyone was reading the same love letter as you were writing it. Or you're sending a photograph of yourself or someone, something, anything, and they first were watching it. Or you decided that you wanted to go demonstrate someplace and they were knowing that you were going to go and demonstrate everything you did, who you spoke to, and not only did they take down your phone and record it, but everyone that you had spoken with. Maybe then we would realize that's exactly what's happening, except it's not 3,000 or 4,000. It's 3 or 4 million people work in the military, industrial, intelligence complex, private contractors. And they have absolutely no interest with the amount of money they're making. And we don't know how much money they're making. We know that one agency is getting $59 billion a year. How much all of it is, we don't know. We do know that $6 trillion has gone missing out of the defense budget. How much of that has gone to private contractors, we don't know. All we know is that we're being spied upon constantly. I think the renowned intellectual historian Quentin Skinner is right in insisting that surveillance is about more than the violation of privacy rights, however important. Under the surveillance state, the greatest threat one faces is not simply the violation of one's right to privacy, but the fact the public is subject to the dictates of arbitrary power it no longer seems interested in contesting. And it is precisely this existence of unchecked power and the wider culture of political indifference that puts at risk the broader principles of liberty and freedom, which are fundamental to democracy. According to Skinner, I want to quote him, he says, "The response of those who are worried about surveillance has far been too much couched, it seems to me, in terms of the violation of the right to privacy, Of course, it's true that my privacy has been violated if someone is reading my emails without my knowledge. But my point is that my liberty is also being violated, and not merely by the fact that someone is reading my emails, but also the fact that someone has the power to do so if they choose. We have to insist that this in itself takes away liberty because it leaves us at the mercy of arbitrary power. It's no use those who have possession of this power promising that they won't necessarily use it, or will use it only when for the common good. What is offensive to liberty is the very existence of such arbitrary power. I would agree with that. The dangers of the surveillance state far exceed the attacks on privacy or warrant simply a discussion about balancing security against civil liberties. The latter argument fails to address how the growth of the surveillance state is connected to the rise of the punishing state. The militarization of American society, secret prisons, state-sanctioned torture, a growing culture of violence, the criminalization of social problems, the depoliticalization of public memory, and one of the largest prison systems in the world, all of which are only the most concrete, condensed manifestations of a diffuse security regime in which we are all interned and enlisted. The authoritarian nature of the corporate surveillance apparatus and the security system, with its urge to survey, eavesdrop on, spy on, monitor, record, and save every communication of any sort on the planet, can only be fully understood when its ubiquitous tentacles are connected to wider cultures of control and punishment, including security-patrolled corridors of public schools, the rise of supermax prisons, the hyper-militarization of local police forces, the rise of military-industrial academic complexes, and the increasing labeling of dissent of any kind as an act of terrorism in the United States. The point of no return in the emergence of the corporate state surveillance apparatus is not strictly confined to the task of achieving this archiving of immense data collection to be used in a number of illegal ways. It is the creating of a culture in which surveillance becomes trivialized, celebrated, legitimized as reasonable and unquestioned behavior. Evidence that diverse forms of public power are sanctioning the security state is on full display in post-Orwellian America, obvious in schools that demand that students wear radio chips so that they can be tracked. Yes, that's happening now. Such anti-democratic projects are now also funded by billionaires like the ultimate fascist, Bill Gates, who push for the use of biometric bracelets to monitor students' attendance in classrooms. The normalization... By the way, Bill, did you finish school? I'm just curious. Did you at Harvard? The normalization of... How would you have felt, Bill? How would all the hedge fund guys feel if they had to be dealt with the same way that normal people do? The normalization of surveillance is also evident in the actions of giant internet providers who use social messaging to pry personal information from their users. The reach of the surveillance culture can also be seen in the use of radio chips and GPS technologies used to track a person's movements across time and space. At the same time, cultures of surveillance work hard to trivialize the importance of massive surveillance by transforming it into a source of entertainment. This is evident in the popularity of reality TV shows like Big Brother or Undercover Boss, which turn the event of constant surveillance into a voyeuristic pleasure. The atrophy of democratic intuitions of culture and governance are evident in popular representations that undermine the meaning of democracy as a collective ethos that unconditionally stands for social, economic, and political rights. One example can be found in Hollywood films that glorify hackers, such as those in the Matrix trilogy, or movies that celebrate professionalized modern spying in the government, agents using their omnipotent technological gizmos to fight terrorists and other forces of evil. What is lost in the culture of surveillance is that spying and the unwarranted collection of personal information from people who have not broken any law is done in the name of security and for commercial purposes and is a procedure often adopted by all totalitarian states. In conclusion, the surveillance state, with its immense data mining capabilities, represents a historical rupture from traditional notions of what we should be as a society. We are no longer emphasizing enlightenment, reason, and social contract. The older, modern society held up the ideals of justice, equality, freedom, and democracy, however flawed. The investment in public goods was seen as central to a social contract that implied that all citizens should be given access to those provisions and resources and institutions and benefits that expand their sense of agency and social responsibility. The new paradigm and its expanding surveillance net subordinates human needs and public goods and the justice to the demands of commerce and the accumulation of capital at all cost. The contemporary citizen is primarily a consumer and an entrepreneur, wedded to the belief that the most desirable features of human behavior are rooted in a basic tendency towards competitive, acquisitive, and uniquely self-interested behavior, which is the central fact of human life today. Today, we are driven by the imperatives of a savage neoliberal political and economic system that embraces what Charles Durber and June Sikira called a public goods deficit, in which budgetary priorities are relentlessly pushed so as to hollow out the welfare state and drastically reduce social provisions as part of a larger neoliberal counter-revolution to lower the taxes of the rich and the megacorporations by selling off public good to private interest. Debates about the meaning and purpose of the public and social good have been co-opted by the politics of fear, relegating notions of civic good, public sphere, and even the very word public to the dustbin of history. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll. From New Mexico, my guest, Ava Golinger. We had I'd given you her background earlier on. She has a degree from Sarah Lawrence and a Juris Doctorate in International Human Rights and Law from City University of New York. She's the author of two main books in The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela, and later Bush versus Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela. Her website is ChavezCode.com. Nice to have you with us today, Ava.
Thank you very much, Gary. I just want to correct you there. I'm actually in New York, not New Mexico.
Oh, okay. At this moment, we're learning more and more about the U.S. government support and financing and public relations and spin media and intelligence giving to some of the most radical, regressive individuals and groups in nations now experiencing violent protests and revolutions. In Syria, although the majority of the Syrians continue to support the Assad government, the U.S. is aiding and abetting al-Qaeda militant groups. We're learning that in the Ukraine, the U.S. and the European Union are fully aligned with right-wing neo-fascist parties intent on overthrowing the government and replacing it with a puppet state, I believe because they want to make that a NATO base right on Russia's doorstep. They also are looking around wherever they can occupy, wherever they can influence. U.S. is backing the Thailand dictator to squash the Occupy Thailand demonstrations, while the Thai government is using terrorist tactics to murder protesters. Earlier, there was the George Bush-supported coup in Haiti and the Clinton coup in Haiti. And now we witness the escalation of violent protests, or what is being called a protest, in Venezuela against the socialist government of Chavez Maduro. In every case, and more can be mentioned, the U.S. speaks the rhetoric of democracy and freedom and demonizes governments that in its dreams are non-democratic or dictatorial. Yet we support the worst political factions in those countries, always have, simply because the U.S. will have greater leverage to bring them into the fold of our free market corporatist imperialist empire. There is a lot to be said about the U.S. backing of Venezuela's aristocratic elite, a small percentage of that nation, given that we have witnessed a series of U.S.-backed coups to topple Hugo Chavez since the time he overwhelmingly came to office in democratic elections. In Obama's budget, $5 million is for the Venezuela opposition groups. So I'd like you to speak on the situation now unfolding in Venezuela and share with us a little bit about what you have uncovered from the thousands of documents you've received from the Freedom of Information Act request that show, prove unequivocally, that the U.S. has defined and strategized the model for the violent demonstrations that are taking place now. And in particular, tell us about the document prepared by the Democratic Internationalism Foundation entitled Strategy or Strategic Venezuelan Plan. And what is this foundation, who's involved with it, and what is its mission and goal with respect to U.S. foreign policy? The forum is yours.
Well, first of all, when you talk about what's happening today in Venezuela, we have to put it into the perspective of what's been happening really over the past decade or so, a little bit more. You referred to the coup that took place against President Hugo Chavez, which was in 2002. And it was led by many of the same people who today are behind these protests or the destabilization in Venezuela against the current government of Nicolas Maduro, who represents the Bolivarian Revolution. And the coup that occurred against Chavez in 2002, when he had just a few years really after he had been elected for the first time in 1998 and taken office in 1999, and had just begun to implement policies that were affecting powerful interests. I mean, we have to remember also Venezuela is the country with the largest oil reserves on the planet. It's very close to the United States. And prior to the Bolivarian Revolution and you know, Hugo Chavez and now Maduro, Venezuela was a client state of the United States. It had governments that were subordinate to U.S. interests. Most of those in office in Venezuela during that time and those that ran the industry were all educated in the U.S., trained in the U.S., and, you know, basically looked towards the U.S. instead of looking at their own country, which is why the infrastructure of the country had deteriorated. Poverty rates were swelling close to, you know, 70-80%, and extreme poverty, even worse, misery in the country. The currency, the economy was in the floor. I mean, everything was really in a bad situation in Venezuela during the 1990s. Also, I mean, it's important when we look at this perspective, that time period from really 1968 through 1998, a 40-year period after the fall of the last dictatorship in Venezuela, which was 1958, is always referred to as the period of representative democracy or the Fourth Republic of Venezuela. During that time period, when oil was nationalized in 1976, and there was a big oil boom, the country was flourishing in terms of its wealth, and the rich got much richer. The poor, of course, got much poorer because they became excluded. The money, instead of going to the state as it was supposed to, it was going into the pockets of those who were in power. They were embezzling it out and buying big homes, which they still have today and live in Miami and in New York and, you know, in the Caribbean islands. And so, the reason that Chavez was elected and the reason the Bolivarian Revolution came into power in Venezuela was precisely to do away with those massive inequalities and mismanagement of government. There was widespread repression. I lived there in that time period in the 90s. There was a national curfew imposed. Constitutional rights were suspended. You know, there were constant arrests. There was a a military draft that was obligatory in a country that had no military enemy. It was just a way of controlling and repressing mainly the lower income and poor youth, men, so that they wouldn't form movements against the government. And so once Chavez wins, breaks free of that two-party system that had maintained power subordinate to foreign interests in the U.S., and his policies start to be implemented, a restructuring of the oil industry on the verge of being privatized, he recovers it and begins, you know, making massive investment from the oil wealth into the country and social programs, and creates all these programs of free health care and education, and, you know, subsidies for housing, for food, you know, getting Venezuelans out of their misery. And over a 10-year period, his policies achieve a massive reduction in that poverty of over 50% and 70% of extreme poverty. But in 2002, the people that had held power before and were subordinate to U.S. interests tried to overthrow Chavez. It's heavily backed by the U.S. But my first book, The Chavez Code, is about, based on, you know, these freedom of information documents that I was able to obtain at that time period, that showed the, you know, just the massive pouring in of millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars to fund these political organizations in Venezuela that came together to overthrow Chavez, 2002. And then that, and then of course there were other documents showing how the CIA was involved and the Pentagon, and, you know, they were going to kill Chavez and take back control of the country and the oil reserves. But something very unexpected happened. And at this stage, you know, a majority of people had supported Chavez overwhelmingly, and the policies that had come into effect had given visibility to millions of people that have been excluded and alienated in the country before, mainly a large working and lower income class of people. And so they weren't going to allow that erosion of their democracy to take place again. They had come together and drafted a new constitution that was ratified by popular referendum in 1999. And so they weren't going to allow that to just be completely destroyed. So the people coming together with loyal armed forces overthrew that coup, defeated it. Chavez was rescued. So we fast forward, you know, 10 years later, basically 12 years later to today, what we're seeing on the ground in Venezuela is basically a very similar situation to 2002. Whereas we have these same organizations funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars through the National Endowment for Democracy, a congressionally created U.S. agency, to fund precisely political activities abroad that promote U.S. agenda, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, which it promotes itself as a humanitarian fund, but a large portion of its funding also goes to this kind of promoting regime change abroad. And so here they are funding these groups, and over the year, I mean, this has been a systematic, you know, an ongoing U.S. interference in Venezuela of how they've been feeding the opposition. Even some of the documents, State Department cables, including ones that were released by WikiLeaks, show how, in the words of State Department officials, where they say that were it not for the U.S. millions of dollars funding the opposition in Venezuela, most of their organizations would no longer exist. So they're basically keeping feeding that conflict. And so today what we're seeing are sort of the culmination of those very same organizations that have been getting that support from Washington and U.S. agencies and covert agencies as well, trying again to destabilize a government that now has been weakened because, of course, Chavez passed away a year ago, and there has been a lot of tension in the country. There have been economic difficulties, some of them the cause of maybe government policies, but many of them also the cause of corporate businesses in Venezuela who've come together to engage in massive speculation, price hikes, as well as hoarding of products, which is an old school strategy in Venezuela to create panic in the population, and is very effective. You know, they're hoarding massive amounts of staple products, sugar, oil, corn flour, toilet paper, and over the past few months, tons and tons of those products have been found in warehouses belonging to these private companies in Venezuela, and other large amounts of them, tons of them as well, have been embezzled across the border into Colombia where they're sold at higher prices, but it's also a way of just getting them out of the country. So they've created this sort of environment of, you know, of discontent in the country combined with the void that Chavez left behind, even though, you know, Maduro, the current president, is continuing all of his policies. Chavez is a very charismatic leader. And so, you know, that they're taking advantage, the opposition forces backed by Washington are taking advantage of this moment to try to propel this destabilization forward. And I think what's been very effective in that is not necessarily the violent protests on the ground in Venezuela, which are being heavily rejected by most Venezuelans because they're just causing major interference in people's everyday lives. They've already caused dozens of deaths for different reasons, most of them not from any kind of government repression, but in fact, for example, the protesters are setting up blockades in the street with barbed wire cables. They're stretching across avenues, and motorcyclists are running through them and being decapitated. And this has already happened at least on four occasions over the past few days. And others have been, have died in transit because they can't get through the blockades, and they're in ambulances, and the protesters won't let them through. I mean, so there's a variety of different, when the media projects figures saying this many people have been killed in protests in Venezuela, they're not giving the full picture as to how those people have actually died. And so part of that strategy that the U.S. agencies have been training these protesters or opposition forces in Venezuela in is precisely how to make better use of that media, take advantage of mass media coordinated campaigns and corporate media that supports the overthrow of the Venezuelan government, regime change, to implement a U.S.-friendly regime, to use the media in a way to show that that it's a brutal dictatorship repressing its people, and that the people out there protesting in the streets represent, the democratic voices of a majority of Venezuelans. But nothing could be further from the truth. While there are legitimate concerns that people have also a constitutional right to manifest through peaceful protest, unfortunately, that's not what's happening in the majority of the situations over the past few days. There have been peaceful protests by the opposition that thankfully have just come out and, demonstrated and then gone home. But what we're seeing every day is different. We're seeing these pocket violent demonstrators that are being egged on by the extremist hardline right-wing leadership in the opposition that, wants to implement regime change and install a free market capitalist U.S.-friendly government that would obviously would roll back Venezuela a decade and a half, if not more, by, taking away all the social programs that have enabled the massive poverty reduction and the increase in participation in political life in the country and in the economy. So the document you referred to that wasn't obtained under FOIA, but rather was a leak that a source gave to me, was actually something produced right before municipal elections took place in December in Venezuela for mayors. And it was a document prepared by three think tanks, two actually in Colombia that are run by ex-president Alvaro Uribe, who's known for his close links and ties to paramilitarism and drug trafficking and is also responsible for the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of Colombians during his reign as president. And he's been an arch enemy of Chavez and now of Maduro, and he wants them out of power, so he's backed the Venezuelan right-wing opposition. And the document was produced during a meeting of two organizations that he runs, along with a U.S. think tank, FTI Consulting, which gets funding from USAID and has close ties to the U.S. government. And basically, they prepared a strategy over a period of months to try to destabilize the country. And part of that, with the goal of either ousting the government through some kind of coup, like what they're trying to do now, or through those elections that took place in December, which the opposition lost. And the government socialist party had a landslide victory of winning over 70% of mayors throughout the country. And so which goes to show, again, that the majority voice still is with the government. But the document outlined a whole strategic plan of how to, for example, engage in sabotage of the electrical infrastructure of the country so that there'd be rolling blackouts, which took place. Interestingly enough, throughout the electoral period, the campaign period last fall, there were blackouts constantly taking place, and the electricity system was going down. And now there's nothing. Everything's fine. And the government kept saying it's sabotage, and they're showing the proof of it. Of course, the media, together with the opposition, is saying, no, it's their fault, it's incompetence. you know, they're not capable of running the country. But in fact, it was sabotage. And so the same thing with the food and the hoarding of products, saying that the government's responsible for the food shortages, when in fact that's part of this plan and strategy that's been in place now for months. Yes.
Well, that was a long answer, but it was very detailed.
Sorry.
We know you're a lawyer. You just proved it. I thank you for coming on and sharing your insights. Ava Golinger, and an important work, The Chavez Code, Cracking U.S. Intervention in Venezuela. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening.
I fell asleep late last night, and I dreamed that the night and almost half the day away. I just got up so that I could